Hey, and thanks for picking up On Science from NPR. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer with the Science Desk. It's Thanksgiving this week, so we're coming to you with the podcast a bit early. For two reasons. First, well, a lot of people travel on Thanksgiving, and we thought we'd be able to keep you company. And second, our offices are closed on Friday, so I won't be here, and we had to get the podcast done a bit early. In honor of the holiday, I asked the reporters here to pick some of their favorite stories from their time here at NPR. And we'll kick it off, appropriately, with turkey. Turkey, of course, is a powerful symbol on Thanksgiving, and that can be problematic for people who usually eat vegetables instead of meat. So on Thanksgiving in 2008, NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce brought us this story of turkeys, vegans, and flexitarians.
Wayne Pacelli is head of the Humane Society of the United States. He's a vegan, which means he eats no animal products. But when he goes to spend Thanksgiving with his family...
There will be some turkey that others eat, and there's nothing I can do about that.
Most vegetarians are used to this kind of social situation. Meat is everywhere. But Thanksgiving is a little different.
You know, I don't think there's any other American holiday that is quite so associated with killing an animal for the table.
Pacelli says a roasted animal carcass isn't tempting for people like him who are committed to vegetarianism. But he says...
You know, there is a large category of people who are eating less meat than they used to, called flexitarians. And I'm sure that among that group of people, this may be a day where they choose to eat some meat.
Flexitarians are part of a growing trend of people generally thinking harder about meat, whether or not to eat it, and if so, what kind is okay. Turkeys can wander around a roomy pasture at Springfield Farm in Sparks, Maryland. Every November, hundreds of people come here to pick up their holiday meal.
I'm David Smith, the owner of Springfield Farm.
And can you tell me sort of what your typical customers are?
I think it's more the issue of people looking to connect with their food, to put a face on it, if you will. Their concerns are local, what the livestock is fed. They want it as natural as possible, and how the livestock is treated, not only on the farm, but also how it's slaughtered.
Those kinds of concerns are why some people just won't eat mass-produced meat.
I stopped eating meat not because I'm against devouring it, but because I didn't like where it was coming from.
That's Jenna Wogenrich. She lives on a small farm in Vermont. She's written a new book called Made from Scratch that describes how she grows her own vegetables.
I've been a vegetarian for over half a decade.
At her family's Thanksgiving, she usually eats tofu instead of meat. But this year, she decided to prepare for the holiday by raising her own turkey. She bought a little bird. He soon became a big white one.
Well, I didn't name him. I made sure I didn't name him. And he was great. I mean, he got along great with the chickens and with all the other farm animals.
She drove him to a nearby farm to have him killed and stored his body in her freezer. But then she ran into a problem. She says some meat-eating members of her family didn't want to consume a known animal.
The turkey situation was a big lesson for me because you go into it way, way too self-righteous. There's a whole spectrum to this, and there's a million different viewpoints, even within one family.
She ended up trading the turkey with someone who agreed to teach her dog to herd sheep. I called up the Farm Sanctuary in New York State. It's a farm animal protection group that runs animal shelters for livestock, plus an Adopt-a-Turkey project. Tricia Berry works there. I asked her what she thought about people who call themselves vegetarians but still plan to eat animals on special occasions.
Who am I to judge or criticize someone for, you know, their journey and their path, whatever it might be?
After all, she says, she herself went through a period of cutting back on meat. But she didn't quit cold turkey until she actually met a turkey, a bird called Cinnamon.
And I actually gave her a belly rub, and she rested into my hand, and I felt, you know, this living, breathing, alive turkey breast.
It reminded her of another turkey breast, the one she'd cooked for Thanksgiving the year before. She says that was the moment when she knew she had to switch from eating less meat to eating no meat. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
I think most folks' least favorite part about the decorative gourd season is the sticky issue of what to do with those leftover pumpkins. But if you live in Lewis, Delaware, and have an itch to destroy that cornucopia of awesome, you are in luck. Every year, on the first weekend in November, folks there hold Pumpkin Junkin', throwing pumpkins mind-boggling distances across a field. This next story, from NPR's Dan Charles, aired on Morning Edition in 1995, when Pumpkin Junkin' was then in its 10th year. It's now in its 25th, and it's safe to say the machines have changed quite a bit, but the goal is still the same.
Pumpkin Chunkin' was born 10 years ago when a bunch of local guys were hanging out in John Ellsworth's blacksmith shop in the beach town of Lewis.
We had had a competition with anvils for 8 or 10 years before that where we threw them by hand. And we could all still do it after 8 or 10 years, but it took several days to recover from it. So we were sort of looking for something else to do. And the idea of building machines to throw pumpkins came up, and here we are.
Thank you very much. Time to rock and roll a little bit.
Where we are is the 10th annual Pumpkin Chunkin' Festival. It's grown into the most spectacular event in town. Some 20,000 spectators are lined up along the edge of the biggest open field the organizers could find. There are stands serving food and beer, helicopter rides, an Elvis impersonator on stage, complete with white bell-bottom jumpsuit and gold scarf. Lined up along one end of the field are the pumpkin-throwing contraptions themselves. They're huge. Slingshots made out of telephone poles, steel towers with long arms that spin like windmills, huge cannons. It's considered bad form here to admit you worked too hard on these machines. Trey Melson is the defending champion.
This whole machine was picked up by the junkyard for about 15 cents a pound. All the pipe, the fittings. You don't buy new stuff for this. You just go to the junkyard and get scrap.
You don't waste a lot of time on rules either.
The pumpkin's got to weigh 8 to 10 pounds. It must leave the machine intact and no explosive charges. And besides that, there is no rules. May the best man win.
In recent years, the competition has expanded. There's now a human-powered division, even a children's division.
All right, you guys ready to go? This is the real thing.
Four little boys are lying flat on their backs in the grass, pulling down with all their might on a wooden bar that holds a 2-pound pumpkin, ready to let it fly.
One, two, three, go! Even better.
All right.
All right.
All right.
All right.
Well, it's pumpkin chunking time again. Come on, all you neighbors and friends.
By noon, the little machines are cleared away. The big boys, plumbers and pipe fitters and blacksmiths with grease on their hands and mud on their overalls, have the field to themselves. Their machines look like an enormous mechanical firing squad. More than half a mile away, just beyond the end of the field, is a potential victim, a small white frame church with a modest little steeple and a banner draped on its roof.
You're going to see pumpkins way down there. I see the church put a target on their roof. I'm not sure that was a good idea.
There's a bullseye on that banner and the words, "Aim here for life." Not all the machines present a serious threat to the church. Loaded Boeing consists of two telephone poles stuck in the earth. Swathes of surgical tubing connect the poles to an orange traffic cone, which holds the pumpkin.
It's the world's largest slingshot.
Team Captain Tom Barton says his inspiration came from an event at the dawn of history.
David and Goliath, I guess. Didn't that guy use a slingshot?
Unfortunately, the pumpkin keeps falling out before it can be launched. Down the line are the towering machines with the whirling arms, the centrifugal machines. The pumpkin here fits in a can at the end of one of the arms. When it's spinning really fast, the can flips open and the pumpkin flies out with tremendous force. So much force, often the pumpkin comes spraying out in little pieces all over the crowd.
Pumpkins are no good.
Watermelon!
Here's a thought.
The best throw by a centrifugal today is just over 1,500 feet. 2 years ago, that throw would have won. This year, it's just a big crowd pleaser. Because 1 year ago, an ominous-looking machine blew away all these competitors, and it's back. Trey Melson's air cannon, Universal Soldier. The 20-foot barrel is covered with camouflage paint. It's surrounded by a crowd of hardcore chunker groupies, big men with beards smoking cigarettes. Trey Melson presides among them with the gruff charisma of a general at war. Last year, this machine threw a pumpkin the previously unthinkable distance of 2,506 feet, almost half a mile. Trey Melson.
It's just a long piece of pipe, and you put air behind it. The more air you can put behind it, the better the punkin flies.
Oh, he's moving it over.
When Melson turns a valve on a tank of compressed air, Universal Soldier fires, and for an instant, you can't see the pumpkin at all. Then, way up in the sky, you see a black dot getting smaller and smaller. Slowly, it arcs back down to Earth. This year, Universal Soldier has competition, an even sleeker air cannon painted all in yellow with an even bigger barrel. It's called Mellow Yellow. The people who built it say it's the latest in produce ballistics. Universal Soldier doesn't manage to throw a pumpkin any farther than last year's record. It's Mellow Yellow's competition to win. Far downfield, a team of spotters on a little motor cart waits to mark where the pumpkin lands.
Holy smokes! All right, we got the point of impact, Danny. We're right here. It's made it official. It's in the church parking lot.
The pumpkin landed about 10 feet from a parked van and splattered into a million pieces. A surveying team with high-tech laser equipment arrives to measure the distance.
26.55. That's a new record, right?
Yeah.
26.55.
Competitors gather around the Mellow Yellow team, bowing low to the ground in honor of the new champions. But there's still the big question.
Why the pumpkin chunking?
Don Jefferson is one of the competitors.
Something for people to do. We all got together a long time ago because nobody had anything to do, and there's all these pumpkins laying around. So we got to figure out something to do with these pumpkins.
It's bragging rights for a year is what it is.
You know the story. The older you get, the bigger your toys are.
Trey Melson, now the former champion, is already plotting the next escalation in the pumpkin chunking arms race. I'm going to build a gun that shoots pumpkins with magnets, he says. Wait till you see that machine. This is Dan Charles reporting.
Just in case you needed one, here's a reason not to tangle with moray eels. Scientists in California found out how morays use a second set of jaws to eat. Here's NPR's Joe Palca, joined by Steve Inskeep, in September 2007.
Scientists can become quite specialized in their work.
I study the evolution of diversity in feeding behaviors, and I'm particularly interested in animals that are really long and skinny.
Rita Mehta is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California, Davis. She started off studying snakes, but now she's turned her attention to eels. It's well known that moray eels have impressive teeth in their mouths. Mehta was interested in a second jaw at the back of their throats that also has teeth.
They have these wicked-looking recurved teeth.
Which teeth do you think I would be more afraid of, the front ones or the back ones?
Oh, man, that's tough. The front ones are really long and sharp, too. I'd be afraid of both.
The teeth in back are attached to something called a pharyngeal jaw. When Mehta used a slow-motion video camera to record a moray feeding, she saw something remarkable.
Once the moray captures prey in its oral jaws, the pharyngeal jaws reach up from the throat region into the oral cavity to grab the prey and pull the prey into the throat and into the esophagus.
If you've seen the movie Alien, you have an idea of what she's describing. A clip from the video Mehta shot is on NPR's website. Mehta reports her findings in the latest issue of the journal Nature. Mark Westneat is curator of zoology at the Field Museum in Chicago. He also studies fish feeding behaviors. He says it's common for fish to have a pharyngeal jaw without teeth they can use for grinding food.
But having a jaw in your throat that has long, recurved canine teeth and can actually shoot out of your throat into your mouth and grab a fish or something and pull it down the throat is highly unusual.
And according to Westneat, quite unexpected.
We thought we knew, you know, most or all of the cool mechanisms that occur in fish skulls, and this is a new one, so it's very exciting.
It's always nice to find something cool and exciting.
That's NPR's Joe Palca. And Joe, I have to ask, how did it take until now before scientists realized that these creatures had an extra jaw that reaches out and grabs things?
Well, actually, they knew about the jaw, but it was the high-speed video camera that actually allowed them to see this reaching out and grabbing, which was pretty remarkable when they saw it. It was one of those aha moments. Do we have a couple more seconds?
For you always, Joe.
Oh, great, because there is a song about morays. You might recognize it.
Oh, yes, I love this song.
Oh, yes.
Let's sing it.
Okay.
When an eel bites your thigh as you're just swimming by, it's a moray. When you scream and you beg, but it still bites your leg, that's a moray. There's a thing on the reef with big white shining teeth. It's a moray.
My fault, sorry.
If he's big and he's mean and he's slimy and green, it's a moray.
We were a little off on that.
Trying
one.
To harmonize.
Oh, sorry. Pull the plug!
When you dance down the street with a clod at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. Excuse me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore.
In April of this year, NPR's Elise Spiegel brought us the story of a mother who's raising a daughter with a rare genetic disability that causes her to trust virtually everyone she encounters. And we'd like to note that for privacy reasons, we're not using the family's last name. Here's the story.
The day before I met her, Jessica had gone to pick up her daughter Isabel at her drama class. It was the usual scene, parents and kids hanging around chattering. Then, out of the corner of her eye, Jessica noticed Isabel carefully making her way towards an elderly woman that Jessica had never seen.
Isabel sidled over to this very nice kind of grandmotherly-looking lady and said, hi, I'm Isabel. And they started talking, and then she said, will you take me, can I go home with you?
Isabel, Jessica's 9-year-old, has Williams syndrome. Williams is a genetic disorder with a number of symptoms. The children are often physically small, there are developmental delays, but also kids and adults with Williams love people and are pathologically trusting. They have no social fear. Researchers theorize that this is probably because of a problem with their limbic system, the part of the brain that regulates emotion. Somehow one of the chemicals that signals when to trust and distrust has been disrupted. This means that it is essentially biologically impossible for kids like Isabel to distrust. Distrust, Jessica says, anyone.
They don't have that kind of evolutionary thing that other kids do, like that just little twinge of anxiety, like, who is this person? What should I do here? Am I going to be okay? They just don't have it. And so she doesn't have that, like, biological warning system.
And for Jessica, Isabel's mother, there are good things and bad things about parenting a kid like this. For instance, when Isabel was little, she was chronically happy. She smiled at anything. She loved everyone, family, friends, strangers.
All it took for her is like the barest beginning of a grin, and then she'd reach out for them to hold her. And, you know, the people who didn't know her, like at the grocery store, just thought, oh, she's so adorable.
And in those days, Jessica says, she and her family were basically tolerant of Isabel's trusting and loving nature.
We would try to restrain her, but it was somewhat half-heartedly because I think we didn't want to embarrass her by kind of calling her on the carpet about how open she was.
But as Isabel got older, the negatives of her trusting nature began to play a larger role. For example, a couple years ago, Jessica and her family were spending the day at the beach.
She had been begging me to go to Dairy Queen. And I said, maybe later, we'll see. Well, she had overheard a lady just down the beach telling her kids, okay, let's go to Dairy Queen. And Isabel went over and got in the lady's van, got in the back seat, buckled up, and was waiting to be taken to Dairy Queen with that family.
Jessica and her kids were frantically searching for Isabel when the driver approached her and explained that she'd been starting her car when she looked up and saw Isabel's face in the mirror. The woman, Jessica says, was incredibly angry.
She said, I am a stranger, you know. And I was thinking, yeah, lady, like, what do you think? You know, I'm an adult. I understand these things. You know, so you can get people kind of blaming you for, like, don't you understand the risks? And it's like, my friend, you have no idea.
In fact, because of Isabel, Jessica has had to rethink even the most basic elements of her day-to-day life.
I don't take her to the dog walk every day with my other kids. I try not to go to the store with her as much as possible. I give her the script about what we're supposed to do beforehand. We're always looking after her because she's like a time bomb waiting to blow her joy over whoever she sees.
And it's not just Jessica who must be vigilant. Every teacher at Isabel's school has been warned. Isabel is not allowed to tell them that she loves them. Isabel is not supposed to tell other school children that she loves them. And there are other restrictions.
She's not allowed to go to the bathroom alone in her school because there have been numerous instances of girls with Williams syndrome being molested at school when they were, you know, alone in the hallway. And these are, you know, like middle-class type schools. So it's a very real problem. And, you know, I would rather her be overly safe than be on CNN.
After I talked to Jessica for a while, I turned off my recorder and we waited for the kids to come home from school. Then, all of a sudden, I felt two little arms circle my neck from behind. Isabel had crept in and was giving me a hug.
So how are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing today?
Good.
Yeah?
So what are you doing here?
I came to visit you. Do you want to sit down?
Sure.
We sat and Isabel asked if she could hold my microphone. Then she decided to sing me a song.
You're my friend in the whole world. You so look so nice, it's so beautiful and so sweet.
Isabel speaks with a slight nasal slur and has some cognitive issues. Though she goes to a regular school, her attention is jumpy and she needs aides to help her. These cognitive issues make Jessica's job more difficult. You see, Jessica has decided that the most important thing for her to do is teach Isabel how to distrust. That is her life project, a pitched battle against biology itself. And so Jessica and her husband have made handmade books about how to behave around strangers, rented videos, and then there are the role-playing exercises. Jessica tells Isabel that they're going to do one of their exercises to show me, that Isabel should pretend Jessica is a stranger.
Hello, little girl. You want to see my puppy?
No way.
Oh, my puppy's so cute.
You sure?
Yes.
Oh, come over here. I've got some candy, too.
Aww.
Come on. Come into my car, and I'll show you.
Okay.
Isabel, are you supposed to go into someone's car?
And this, Jessica says, is how it goes. Sometimes she remembers and doesn't tell strangers that she loves them. Mostly, she does. But Jessica is determined.
It's like we just have to restart every time. That's just what we have to do.
Have to do, Jessica reasons, because she won't be around forever to protect her daughter. And though Isabel trusts the world completely, the world is not a place worthy of complete trust. Even in their current life, Jessica says, there are moments that she realizes that she is just a turned head away from something terrible.
We live a very sheltered life, but I can think of times when, you know, we were at the pool and I turned around to talk to someone and I see her practically sitting on some man's lap, you know, at the pool who looks very uncomfortable. And I just think, like, this is not good.
So Jessica tries, and she says Isabel is slowly learning. For instance, late in the day, she came up to Jessica after she heard us talking again about the time she was at the beach and got into the van with a stranger.
Are you mad at me, Mom?
I forgive you, honey. You just try not to do it again.
And to be fair, there are plenty of rewards to this life, and Jessica is fully aware of them.
She'll ask me, "So how are you today, my darling?" And it just makes you smile.
Okay, what kind of pizza do people
you have?
Late in the afternoon, on the day that I visited, everyone in the family gathered in the kitchen to eat dinner. Isabel loves music, so she decided to play a CD. The CD player stuttered, then came to life, and Isabel turned to her father. "Would you dance with me, my sweetie?" she asked. Her father picked her up in his arms. He spun her round and round. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Goodbye.
Next, we'll find out how a changing climate could affect the food source for billions of people. That food is rice, and most people in Asia depend on it. It grows on wet rice paddies, but too much water can kill it. NPR's John Hamilton brought us this story from October of 2007. It was part of our series with National Geographic called Climate Connections.
The weather in Asia this year has been ferocious. Monsoon rains have inundated countries from the Philippines to Nepal. Super typhoons slammed into China and Japan. And a heat wave in Pakistan pushed the temperature to 125 degrees Fahrenheit. All of this is bad for rice. And what's bad for rice is especially bad for Bangladesh. The people of Bangladesh get about two-thirds of their total calories from rice. In the capital, Dhaka, food markets are divided into two major areas, one for fish and one for rice.
So we're in the Karan Bazaar, and I'm going to buy some rice as soon as our rice seller gets off the phone.
Yes.
What type of rice are you selling here?
Miniket, Nadi Shail, Katari.
My salesman is wearing a blue tunic and a white prayer cap. He works his way down a line of burlap sacks overflowing with rice. The cheap stuff is coarse and brown. Upscale rice is fine, white, and polished. The man in line behind me is eager to talk.
Rice is daily food for everyone, from poor to rich. It's one of the essential things, like salt.
The man's name is Shamim Ahmed. He says when the rice crop fails, people starve. He still remembers the terrible floods of 1974.
That year, nearly all the places got submerged, and that is why there was no rice production, and people had no work. So a lot of people died.
Nearly a million dead. Since then, scientists have been trying to create rice that survives flooding. Woo! Ah! 2,000 miles away in the Philippines, scores of hungry birds are eyeing plots of experimental rice. Woo! A man with a white flag pedals back and forth on a bicycle to scare the birds away. Ah! This is the International Rice Research Institute. Woo! Bob Ziegler is the director. He's a plant pathologist who started out in the Peace Corps. To him, rice is a powerful engine that can drive away hunger, malnutrition, and poverty. But not if it's underwater.
Even a crop like rice, which grows in standing water, cannot stand to be totally submerged. It'll drown like any other plant.
Usually in just 3 or 4 days. But scientists here have discovered a gene that lets rice essentially hold its breath for up to 2 weeks. It's called the Submergence 1 gene, Sub 1 for short. Dave McKill led the team that discovered the gene. We follow him along an earthen levee that separates two rice fields, each about the size of a tennis court.
What you could see on the left with the variety with the sub 1 gene, it looks pretty much like a normal crop. This field was under submergence for 12 days.
It's thick with brilliant emerald stalks that are nearly waist high. The paddy on the right was also submerged for 12 days. The rice here is patchy and stunted. It's the exact same variety, but without the sub 1 gene. Bob Ziegler says that rice plants with the flood resistance gene have huge potential in places like Bangladesh.
If they produce the way we expect they will, it will be a massive impact in that part of the world. I mean, it will be a spectacular demonstration of the power of science to make a difference in people's lives.
But only if the new rice does as well in the real world as it has in the Institute's carefully groomed paddies. It doesn't get any more real than northern Bangladesh, where the vast Brahmaputra River often spills over its banks and into the fields of struggling rice farmers. A farmer named Gobindra Chandra Rai is working in his field, which had been completely underwater just a few weeks earlier.
When it was flood, the whole area was submerged. How high? It was high up to the waist.
Gobindra says the government gave farmers in his village seedlings with the flood-resistance gene. But the monsoon floods came early, and he was the only farmer to plant them in time. As the water rose, Gobindra and his neighbors watched his field anxiously.
It was underwater for about 8 days.
And with ordinary rice, if it were underwater for 8 days, what would happen?
Usually what would happen if the local brands are underwater, that will be damaged from the flood. But this new brand still lives.
So ordinary rice would have died here?
Yes.
But this rice is thriving. Gobindra wades down a row. If a stalk is leaning, he straightens it. If a leaf is muddy, he squeezes it clean between two wet fingers. Then he strokes the plant as if it were a kitten. Gobindra says his neighbors are amazed by what they've seen in his paddy. We slog our way out of the fields to meet them. The whole village turns up to talk about the new rice. They form a semicircle in front of a shed made of bamboo and corrugated sheet metal. Men up front, women further back, little boys climbing anything tall to get a better look. Many of the farmers can't read or write, but when it comes to rice science, they're at the cutting edge.
Who expects to plant the sub one variety of all the people here? Everybody.
Every single farmer raises his hand. The farmers also know something about the power of weather. Noli Chandrabaman is 70. He remembers living on banana leaves when monsoon rains drowned the rice crop. He worries that the rains are becoming more and more unpredictable.
The current situation is when they expect rain, they don't get rain, and during the drought season, they get rain. So the whole climate has changed totally.
And flooding isn't the only change associated with global warming. There's also the prospect of more severe droughts. And as the sea levels rise, salt water will leak into the rice fields near the coast. Scientists in the Philippines are trying to find genes to solve these problems, too. Again and again, the villagers try to explain what all these threats mean to them. Finally, one man tries a few words of English before lapsing back into Bangla.
Rice is the main food of our country.
And without rice?
Without rice, we cannot live. Unbelievable.
What he said in Bangla was, "We just can't imagine anything else." John Hamilton, NPR News.
That's all for this special Thanksgiving edition of the On Science podcast from NPR. Feel free to troll through the archives and find all of the latest science news at our website. That's npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince.